This is Embodied on the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. How do we think about death during a pandemic when normally we don't like to think about it at all? The coronavirus outbreak has forced us to acknowledge the mortality of our loved ones and ourselves in ways we're not used to. And social distancing makes processing that individual and collective grief even more difficult. So how is COVID-19 shaping our relationship with death and dying? It's our topic today. Tanya Marsh is with me. She's a law professor at Wake Forest University and host of the podcast Death at SEC. Tanya, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we invite you to join our conversation today on Twitter. Use the hashtag #EmbodiedWUNC. You can also watch the show live on Facebook. You can check it out on our page at The State of Things. So, Tanya, you spend a lot of time thinking about death and funerals and cemeteries, and I wonder kind of if you could characterize what Americans' relationship with death was in the before time, kind of our cultural relationship with death before this pandemic.
Sure. So a lot of people describe American society as a death-denying culture, and actually I like Caitlin Doughty's description of America as a death-illiterate culture. We're just so separated from death in the normal course. I mean, I feel like we're talking about before and after times, right?
Right.
but before the current pandemic, death occurred away from the home for the most part, in hospitals, in retirement communities or hospice. It was separated from the living. And then the process of preparing deceased people for final disposition was also separated from sort of the normal flow of human life. And most death was expected. Of course, there's always unexpected death, accidental death, et cetera. But most deaths, we had some time to sort of get used to the idea, right? Most people that were dying were people who were older, near the end of their expected natural lifespans, et cetera. But still, we were caught in this sort of paralysis when death does occur, that most people don't think through the logistics. Most people die without a will in the United States, right? Let alone having contacted a funeral home or a cemetery or made any sort of arrangements for the disposition of remains after death. So we were just really unprepared to deal with those realities of death, sort of socially.
And there's a whole industry set up to take care of bodies, to prepare for this transition. And all this in many ways reflects this kind of separation between us and the process of death and dying. And I want to start with a clip. This is from a nurse who has been taking care of COVID-19 patients in New York City. He's a travel nurse, and he has witnessed so much more death than he ever had before because of the coronavirus pandemic.
We had like a wave of deaths go through the ICU. So we had four people code or go into cardiac arrest that didn't survive. And that was very difficult to deal with. I've never worked a shift until I got here. We had that many people go into cardiac arrest and, you know, pass away. And I think the most difficult thing about the COVID-19 situation is that these patients are isolated by themselves. You know, they can't really see the face of the caregivers because we have so much protective gear on to protect ourselves. And then, you know, if they're not doing good, we're not allowing family to come up there because of how contagious this virus is. And family can't even come see them until, you know, we've taken them off the unit and down into the morgue. And even when they're down there, they're only allowing people to come view the body for a few minutes before they have to leave.
So that was Nurse Marcus Wilson sharing his thoughts on what he is seeing patients and families go through at his hospital in the Bronx. I'm speaking with Tanya Marsh, who's a law professor at Wake Forest University and host of the podcast Death at SEC. And you can join our conversation on Twitter with the hashtag #EmbodiedWUNC. So Tanya, he's in New York City, which is really at the epicenter of all of this. And I know that you have spent some time talking with fellow colleagues. You spoke in your most recent podcast with a funeral director in New York. And she shared with you how this pandemic is really illuminating kind of some structural flaws in the death care system and is really causing such a degree of overwhelm for people in her position. So tell me a little bit about what you heard from her and what this is exposing about our industry and how we take care of people who are dying and who pass away.
Sure. So the death care system in New York City metro area right now is completely overwhelmed. And in the last episode of the podcast, I talked to Amy Cunningham, who's a funeral director in Brooklyn. In the next one, which is not published yet, I talked to a couple folks with the New York State Association of Cemeteries. So, and I heard consistent stories from both of them. The normal number of people who would die in New York City at this time of year on any given day is about 160. From COVID death alone, I think the low point was about 480, and the high point was 799 in the course of a day from COVID alone. So you already have a system that's completely overtaxed in terms of, you know, when a person dies, there are two different issues. There's the issue of grief, right? And then there's a logistical issue of body disposition. And many of our death rituals have conflated the two, wrapped the two up, right? The funeral is the way that we express grief and process grief, and it's also a method leading to body disposition. But what we've seen in New York is because of the challenges to the whole system based on the sheer number of bodies that it's having to deal with, is we're bifurcating those two things. So people can't be with their loved ones when they're dying, as the gentleman that had the clip described. They can't spend time with the body after death. They can't do a traditional viewing. They can't do a funeral. The funeral homes are, for the most part, closed because they've run out of refrigerator space, and they've converted their chapels into temporary morgues. In some cases, turning the air conditioning down as low as possible, which is still way too warm for that purpose. Amy's funeral home in Brooklyn should be able to store 10 bodies. When I spoke with her on Saturday, they had 62.
Wow.
The folks in the cemeteries that I spoke to have shut down their own chapels on the cemetery grounds, and they've turned those into temporary waiting areas. There's only 5 crematories in the New York City metropolitan area. And they can cremate running double shifts, running 16 to 20 hours a day. They can only cremate 85 people a day. So we have more than 5 times that many people dying every day in New York. They're scheduling cremations for 3 weeks out. They're scheduling burials for at least a week out. And the bodies have to be somewhere in the meantime. Now, compound that with one thing that I was really surprised to learn when I talked to Amy was how many people are dying at home, right? So at least in the hospital, you have some process of caring for the body, putting it into a body bag, having a refrigerated truck or the morgue where they can wait for a funeral director to come and claim the body. But when folks die at home, whether it's from COVID or from something unrelated, family calls a medical examiner. The medical examiner has been telling people if it appears to be natural causes, they'll just have a physician sign off on the death certificate and is instructing families to call funeral directors. Well, funeral directors have 62 bodies in the chapel, right? So funeral directors are so backed up with the process that they don't have anywhere to put bodies, that there have been significant delays in getting to the home to take the body from the family. So people are being forced to confront death in very real ways that we are not used to in this country.
Yeah. I want to bring in another guest to the conversation now, Nina Jones Mason. She's a funeral director with LSD Jones & Sons Funeral Services in Durham. Nina, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So we heard Tanya describe the situation in New York City, really dire, such an immense amount of pressure on the whole system. I know in North Carolina, we have had many fewer deaths, about 242 confirmed deaths, as opposed to close to 10,000 in New York State. So a very different kind of scope. But tell me about how this moment has changed your business. I mean, funerals were deemed an essential business in North Carolina, but how have the guidelines shaped what you all are able to do for families?
Yes. So things are definitely a lot different than New York. The New York situation, as Tanya described, is dire, and it is extremely overwhelmed. We here in North Carolina, for good or bad of it, we have, you know, really not had that system be in test like that. It has had an overwhelming effect on the ability for families to remember their loved ones in the way that they do that, the way that they celebrate, the way that they come together to grieve. And that has been the difference here in North Carolina. When we got our stay-at-home order, Governor Cooper originally had a limit of 100 people to gather together. And at first, I mean, I had so many families, that was just devastating to go down to 100. Can you imagine? Most funerals are more than 100 and can be up from 300 to 500 people easily. We come together for these ceremonies. So to go down to 100 was a big deal when we first started our stay-at-home order. Then the order went to 50. That became a really big deal as well. And then at that same time, our churches were closed. So you go from being able to have services at churches to being really limited to having services at cemeteries or at the funeral home. So that has been the major change for many of our families here in North Carolina, because things are closed, and so they're very limited in where they can have their service, and now you're limited as well as to the number of people. So you have our chapel, unfortunately, I don't feel comfortable having 50 people and using social distancing and things like that. So every funeral home in North Carolina is kind of, unfortunately, they're having to assess their own needs, their own requirements, their own level of comfort. So every family is going to get a different situation depending on the funeral home that they go to.
I'm going to pause you there, and we're going to continue this conversation after a short break, hear more about how it's changing the funeral process and how that differs culturally in different parts of the country. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is Embodied on the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. We continue our conversation on death and the coronavirus pandemic with a look at funerals. Due to changing guidelines, some families have had to postpone memorial services for loved ones. Let's hear from a listener named Crosby Lupton. She and her family decided to postpone her father's memorial service.
It's been hard to not have closure, but it's also given us the space to really think about how to honor my dad. And me specifically, I think, after someone dies, there's all this pressure to go ahead and get the service started. And you don't really have time to think about how is this affecting me? Is this really what this person who died would have wanted? Because you're so caught up in the logistics. And so for me, the space has given me a lot of time to think about how I want to honor my dad. And I've, looked back through his Facebook, and he shared a lot of, he would share a lot of images of songs that he liked. And I'm maybe I'll put together a playlist of those songs that he shared on his Facebook. And it's given me time for that.
So that was Crosby Lupton, who lives in New York, but is quarantining in Harnett County with her family. And it is Embodied today. And I'm speaking with Tanya Marsh and Nina Jones Mason. Tanya is a law professor at Wake Forest and host of the podcast Death at Sec. And Nina Jones Mason is a funeral director in Durham. You can join our conversation on Twitter with the hashtag #EmbodiedWUNC. You can also watch a live stream of today's show on Facebook. So, Nina, we heard from Crosby about her family's switch in plans. Her father passed away before the epidemic really took hold in North Carolina, and they have been able to use this time to plan, and it has kind of given her some time to process her grief. Not the case for all families, I'm sure. But how have you seen families change what they want because of the guidelines or because of the fact that death is happening in this moment?
Yes, definitely. There are some families that, knew they wanted, if they wanted cremation, they knew that, and some are choosing to hold off on their memorial service till later instead of going ahead and planning that memorial service. I had a family who pre-planned, and they still decided to postpone their memorial service. They really did not feel that a limit of 50 or 30 people was going to be sufficient enough. And they were comfortable waiting. Then I have my families where we're talking about burial, and that is where most of them are going ahead with the ceremony. And then we're getting very, very creative. We're trying to help people as much as possible and give them as many options as possible when they want to go forward, be that live streaming, be that just everything that we can do, allowing the maximum number of people, but at the same time just trying to be as safe as possible to honor the their loved one and their memory, but at the same time being respectful of the ordinances that are in place as well.
Well, how do you do that? I mean, that seems like a really tricky thing to balance, kind of given that you know, you're supposed to be 6 feet away. You're really not supposed to be touching these group hugs, these moments of tenderness that can happen in ceremonies. I mean, what has that been like to have to kind of police that and navigate that in this environment?
I would say that has been one of the most heartbreaking things. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize how much I hugged until all of this started. You know, you really see the things that you do as well. But I hug a lot, and I'm so used to hugging my families when they come in the door and giving them that support and love. And I can't do that, and it is so weird. And for them as well, we're not having visitations anymore. So if we do have a service, usually there's some visitation time the night before, the day before, or even a little bit an hour before, but we're not doing that. We're really literally walking people in, sitting them down, and asking them to stay in their seat unless they have to go to the restroom. But no hugs. And I've seen it transform where it was very hard in the beginning and where I had to make the announcement to remind people not to hug. And that was heartbreaking. And then now it is a little bit more natural to people. We're over a month in, and it's a little bit more natural, which is really, really, you know, that's the difference. You go in for a hug, you go in for a moment to give people support, and they don't have that. There are no limousines now, because do you really want to, you know, be in that small confined space, just like I'm sure people don't want to get into Lyfts or Ubers. You know, those vehicles are not your own. So, and, you know, just trying to keep everybody safe. And it's really, really a change and definitely a lot to take in.
Well, Tanya, I mean, public health and grief have always been two concerns that the funeral industry has had to hold together. Could you kind of talk about the intersection of those and, you know, how this moment may change how we think about weighting both of those as we think about the death care industry as a whole?
Well, I think our death rituals have changed over time, you know, in big ways and in small ways, and they adapt to changing circumstances. When this all started, it immediately made me want to reread Drew Gilpin's Faust book, This Republic of Suffering, about all the changes in American death culture following the Civil War. Because there you had mass death that occurred away from home. Most families never got to see the bodies of the soldiers who died, whether it was in the North or the South. They never got to see them again. They had to change how they processed grief, right? So I think any large traumatic event like this is going to have ripple effects. And maybe, like I was suggesting earlier, this is going to cause us to think about the disposition of the body as more about a public health as opposed to processing of grief. I don't know. I mean, you know, and every area of the country is going to experience it differently because, as Nina was just describing, North Carolina hasn't thankfully had the kind of death that they've experienced in New York. So we may see sort of regional differences, which we already have regional
right.
differences in death processes, but we may see that even more clearly after the impact of this is felt.
And the challenge, too, is, I mean, the concern about the disease and the passing of the disease doesn't even go away once someone has passed away. The WHO, I know, at first said, no, we don't think that the disease can linger on after a body has passed. But now they're saying, well, it may. So there's all of these concerns for people in the industry about how to protect themselves around these bodies and keep themselves safe. I know, Nina, you held your first service for someone who died of COVID-19 yesterday. Can you walk us through how you handled that and the challenges of being able to keep your employees safe, balancing that with trying to respect the wishes of the family?
Yes. Since all this started, when we spoke with our staff and everything, we decided to treat everyone as if they had COVID. That's the first thing. And that way we don't we get practice in taking those precautions, and we take everything under the same care. So with COVID and just with everything else, you don't know who has it. You don't know who's walking through the door with it. So we're just going to treat it all as the same. And that way we are disinfecting, just like with the bodies, we are taking care to do that. The families know what's going on. We have made the decision to go ahead and honor families that would like embalming and like a funeral service for COVID cases. We have agreed to that. We were comfortable with that. The family was comfortable with that. So you really have to go with the level of comfort, and being able to honor that for them was really what they needed and was really good, because they were not able to see her beforehand. Mm. And that level of grief, you know, when you have, you know, your loved one is not doing well, you haven't been able to see them for weeks. They really weren't sick to the point of dying. They were just in a rehab facility, and what was supposed to be okay and come out, they did not. You know, that's devastating, and they needed that closure and needed that time. And we were just really thankful that we were able to support them and give them that during this time.
Tanya, I know when you spoke with the funeral director, Amy, she told you about how she thinks this moment has really distilled the funeral process into kind of its essence, and into trying to figure out, you know, what are the best, safest ways to do this, and what are the things that families really need, and how can I provide those services? Do you think that this is going to have a long-term lasting change on how we culturally think about dying and the death process?
Well, I think yes, because this isn't just going to be 5 weeks and then it's over, right? We're not going to have a vaccine for 18 months. Who knows how long this is going to go on? 9/11 was one day and killed far fewer people than it died in New York from the current pandemic. And that's still with us, right? So I think whenever we sort of experience this kind of level of social mass trauma, it really does have a lasting impact. And I think Amy's right. These sorts of situations force us to really rethink what it is that is important, what it is that we value and that we need. What does our grief need? How can we express it? How can we try and make each other feel better in a community, especially when that community, as Nina suggested, can't hug, right? The most fundamental things that sort of brought us together and how we expressed ourselves before, if we can't do those things, if those avenues are cut off to us, what other ways can we express ourselves and try and get down to the basics of what we really need as people?
And Nina, I mean, there are moments of joy, right, in funerals and in celebrating life. And I know that's a big part of the work that you do and the work that you do in helping families put together various ceremonies. So have there been moments of joy still that have come out in the celebrations since this all happened? And what form has that taken?
Definitely, definitely forms of joy. I think Tanya's correct in terms of the rethinking of what we need for funerals. I think, I'll be honest, I agree with her concept of death defining, you know, denying culture. I think for a while, you know, people haven't really considered the need for community during grief. You know, we've kind of pulled away, oh, well, we may have a service or we may not, or, you know, people say, oh, just throw me away, I don't need all of that, or whatever. And then I think what people are realizing now about the funeral industry, that it is about the deceased, but it's for the family. And to be able to come together and bring that joy to other people, you know, is important. I think until you're told you can't do it, you know, you don't realize how much you need it and how important it is until you're like, okay, we can't do that. You know, and it becomes really important to people. So the songs that people sing, we had a group come and sing to the family last week. They were, and they sung outside to them and just was able to give that family that song of encouragement. And though it was standing far away, and though it wasn't 100 people at the funeral, it was what the family needed. And that support can bring, that brings the joy, you know?
Totally. All right, I'm going to say goodbye now to Tanya Marsh. She is a law professor at Wake Forest and hosts the podcast Death at SEC. Tanya, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Still with me is Nina Jones Mason, a funeral director in Durham, and I want to bring in another guest to the conversation now, Dr. Raymond Barfield. He's a pediatric oncologist and palliative care physician at Duke Health, and over the years, he has become an expert in processing death and end-of-life care. Ray, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. It's good to be back.
And I want to play a clip for both of you to reflect on that kind of summarizes a lot of these tensions we've been talking about and concerns that people are having that are new in this moment. This is a clip from a front desk worker at a retirement home in Asheville.
They are left alone in their grief through no one's fault. A friend who lost a loved one. I would dearly love to sit with her. Just sit. And we can't do that. She posted of the loss of her mother on the Facebook page, very briefly, just her mother's obituary, and there were 115 responses. That's 115 people who cannot go to a funeral right now, who can't go to her house, who can't take anything.
That's Deborah, a front desk worker at a retirement community in Asheville, talking about how this moment has changed life for her and has changed grieving. And Ray, I want to turn to you maybe for a little bit of solace as we close out the little bit of this segment of thinking about community in this moment and the importance of community as we grieve. And it looks so different now when we can't kind of be physically together. As Nina mentioned, you know, people can't hug within the funeral home. For you, I mean, how have you seen community grieving play a role in how we process death, and how important is that?
Oh, it's crucial. And in the hospital where I work, we have people who are thinking about their deaths, people who have cancer or have something that's not necessarily COVID, but they're thinking about their death and they're afraid. And they're alone because they aren't allowed to have visitors in the hospital. And that has underscored just the power of being with other people and the power of knowing that we're not alone. There's something about loneliness that this COVID experience has underscored, and I think a lot of us are going to be thinking a lot more about it. Nina had mentioned that once the funeral is not possible or can't be done in the way that people would like to do it, all of a sudden a light has shined on how much it matters. And I think that that's been a pervasive experience with the COVID virus, how much it matters to be with other people and to connect with other people and to not be alone. And so that's been very powerful. And I suspect as we move, when we move, into a place where we're able to be together again, that we will come together in a different way than we have in a very long time.
Yeah. Well, Nina, I mean, you kind of have to serve as a grief counselor in a lot of ways in your role because you are the first point of contact for a lot of families as they're beginning to process this next phase of a loved one's life. So how has, you know, how has this changed your job? I mean, do you have a different kind of approach to talking to grieving families, acknowledging that there's this collective grief also going on right now?
I think that you have to have a certain level of patience, compassion, and understanding during this time. And you have to really, as long as families know that you care, to be honest, I have a psychology background from UNC, and every day that comes into care, it comes into use as I care for these families. I think that you have to listen as well to what's going on and figure out what the need is. So every family needs something different, and every family in their grief process is just like every funeral isn't alike, every family is different. And what I'm having to do is kind of listen for what it is that is most important to them and seeing if I can give them that, at least that small part. And then we make a plan to go forward and work from there, and that changes their outlook, that helps them out some, and brings a little bit of comfort, knowing, okay, I can do this. You know, they hear about all the restrictions, but I try not to focus on the restrictions. I say, okay, let's talk about the things that we can do, and bringing that positivity into the room, because they've been told no before they get to me. They've been told no by everything, no from the hospital, no from the nursing home, no, 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 you can't do this. So when they come into my funeral home, we're really talking about, let's talk about what we can do. So that's the way I'm kind of supporting and helping my families.
We're going to continue our conversation just ahead. I'm with Nina Jones-Mason, a funeral director with LSD Jones & Sons Funeral Services in Durham. You can hear more about her story and what's going on at her funeral home from reporting by our own Leonita Inge. You can find that on our website, stateofthings.org. Also with me is Dr. Raymond Barfield, a pediatric oncologist and palliative care physician with Duke Health. Just ahead, how to handle grief while social distancing. Please stay with us. This is Embodied on the State of Things. I'm Anita Rao. Death in a time of pandemic is our topic today. Many of our normal processes for grief and closure have been upended by the coronavirus outbreak. My guests are Nina Jones-Mason, funeral director at LSD Jones & Sons Funeral Services in Durham, and Dr. Raymond Barfield, a pediatric oncologist and palliative care physician at Duke Health. And I want to start with another clip. This is from Melissa Swarbrick. Her sister Kathleen was on immunosuppressants and passed away from complications related to COVID-19 earlier this month.
She continued to want to press our parents not to go out, and they don't stay home at all. They're at church, they're at the store, they're out to eat. And I kind of thought that was ridiculous. And I said, you know, wash your hands, everything will be fine. And it's not a big deal, you're healthy. And she kept pressing that it was something serious. And, you know, looking back, maybe she had a little bit of, you know, just that gut feeling. But then the second week of March is when she was home. She hadn't left the house in a week or so, and then a couple more weeks went by, and then it was April 2nd, actually, when she got sick and went to the emergency room, and it just hit her like a brick, and within 4 or 5 hours, they had put her on a ventilator. I kept thinking that, oh, tomorrow, you know, something great will happen. They tried everything, different antibiotics, and those everything they gave her, she actually got worse, and we never got to talk to her again.
That was Melissa Swarbrick from Pinehurst talking about how her sister Kathleen died of complications related to COVID-19. I'm here with Nina Jones-Mason, a funeral director in Durham, and Dr. Raymond Barfield, a pediatric oncologist and palliative care physician at Duke Health. So, Ray, I would love for you to respond a little bit to that clip from Melissa and anything you would kind of advise for families who are dealing with, you know, processing grief away from the body without having those closing rituals of being able to see someone, being able to hold their hand in these moments. And, you know, hospitals have varying procedures trying to protect public health, but it's a big challenge for families who are left away.
It is. And one of the things that I would say is similar to something that Nina was talking about when she has folks who come in who've been told no, 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 and she changes the conversation and says, well, what is it that we can say yes to? And that is crucial. That is something that I have borrowed from the way that, you know, 12-step programs work, something called the Serenity Prayer, which is, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And one of the things that is a common thread when we're facing difficult, you know, it can be a disease, it can be the economic impacts of something like COVID, it can be anything in a life that's disruptive, to put energy into things that we can't change. Well, if we can't help it, okay. But if we can recognize the difference between things that we cannot change, no matter how much energy we put into them, and things we can change, and start asking a different kind of question, we can at least begin letting some light into the room. And so that's one thing that my residents probably get tired of hearing me talk about, the serenity prayer before I walk into the room to be with a family who's wrestling with something difficult. I think it's crucial, though, to think about that. The other thing I would say is that in the clip that you played, you know, it is all too easy to look backwards and to think, maybe I should have done this. Maybe I should have recognized the signs. Maybe I should have said something different. Maybe I should have spoken more quickly. Maybe I should have gone to the hospital more quickly. Maybe, you know, on and on. But for the most part, you know, we make the best decisions that we can. And in this COVID pandemic, if you look at everything from top leadership to hospital leadership to the ways that families are trying to respond to adversity, we're having to make it up as we go. None of us have experienced this kind of worldwide shutdown and crisis. And so I think there is more than enough room for grace, for a sense of grace towards ourselves and towards others as people genuinely try to do the best that they can in a confusing, bewildering time. So those are two things that I bring into the room myself every time I'm on service. I'm on service now, and I finished rounds right before this show and brought these very things into the rooms.
How prepared are physicians to have these conversations? I mean, you obviously are really used to working with families who are dealing with end-of-life care challenges and issues, but there's so many healthcare workers right now who are being thrown into this who, you know, are dermatologists, are podiatrists, are people who aren't usually used to thinking about caring for people near the end of their life. Do you think that this is going to have an impact on how we think about death in the healthcare industry for providers?
I sure hope so. Mm-hmm. I think that if I'm any gauge for how others were trained in talking about death, talking about difficult things like this, we're not very good at training people. I had to learn after I was a bone marrow transplant physician taking care of dying children. I had to learn by discovering that I was perfectly fine as long as I was wearing a hero's cape. But when I had to walk into the room and say that we had moved beyond the last beacon of possibility for cure and now had to have a different kind of conversation, I didn't know how to have it. And it took me years, but I have learned from many different people, patients, families, nurses, chaplains, social workers, you name it. And this is something that is teachable, and it's something that is learnable, but it needs to be brought to the center of the way that we form clinicians.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I'm hoping that this has a big impact. I'll tell you, I think that among healthcare providers, not knowing how to talk about this is going to be a significant part of the trauma that we address later, and you don't address it in the middle of the crisis when you're the healthcare provider. You just do what you need to do. But later on, we're going to have to talk through the moral trauma of not knowing how to be present to patients and families who are suddenly and on a large scale having to have conversations that people don't feel equipped to have.
Nina, for you, I mean, death is a fact of every day of your job. It's something that, you know, is ingrained in the work that you do. So do you have a version of a serenity prayer or something like that that guides your philosophy for approaching this work?
If it's not the serenity prayer, I guess the main thing that I think about, a lot of people always ask me, how do you do this work? How do you do it? You know, it's a lot. I'm a licensed embalmer as well, so they always think about how I deal with the bodies and all these things. And I tell people all the time that my focus is always and always on the family. I can't focus on myself. I'm not that important to this situation. And when you can focus on someone other than yourself and you can have compassion and you can recognize that what they are going through is grief, then you are able to help people. Everybody's grief is going to be different. Everybody's situation is going to be different. Some people are going to be extremely angry, and some people are going to be, you know, extremely sad, and then you're going to have people in the middle who are calm and okay where they are. And you have to learn to meet, I have to learn, and I have learned over the years that I just meet people where they are. Meet people where they are, find out what their needs are, and go from there and let them know that I'm here to help. Like I said, by the time they get to me, they are usually spent, they're either overwhelmed, and they have no clue. And I tell them that I am here to do as much for you as possible. When you sit down at my table in my conference room, I'm here to do as much as for you as possible. So if you can tell me what it is that you need, I'm going to tell you what it is that has to be done, and then you can talk to me about what it is that you want and need, and we can go from there. So making it a conversation. I usually do not tell people what they have to do or what they can't do. We talk about what you want to do and have conversations with people. And that's the goal when families come to my funeral home.
I'm curious about faith and the role that it plays in all of this. And I know the funeral industry has changed so much over time. And, you know, we have more end-of-life celebrations now. More people are cremating now. People are less tied to religious institutions now than they once were. And I wonder how you've seen that shape how the grief conversation goes and the things that people want out of funerals and out of these end-of-life celebrations.
I think before, there was less conversation about the value of the ritual and the value of seeing their loved one. Everybody wants to focus on, oh, we're just going to have a party. We're going to, you know, I don't want all of that, that kind of conversation. And like I said, when you are not allowed to do something, you realize the value. Faith in the African-American community, I can say, has always been a cornerstone and has still been a major factor with our funerals. And to make sure that we still have that during this time, you have to realize that the atmosphere is so much different. Mm. When you have a pandemic like this, it can seem like it's not a joyous occasion. When you have a loved one that's been struggling for years and you want to celebrate their wonderful 98-year life, you know, now you have loved ones who are passing away, and with the coronavirus around, even if it's not a corona case, it just adds an added layer of sadness to it. And I think that having that grace and asking for God's grace and mercy and support during this time is very important. And families have been leaning on it and having to find that religious support. Of course, like I said, our churches are closed, so that is a challenge. But our ministers are there. So though we don't have our churches, we do have our ministers, and we are very appreciative of every last one of them that have come to support this family, even though they don't have to.
I'd love to close out our conversation today talking about any opportunities that this moment presents us to maybe talk more about what we want from the end of our life or get clearer with family members and find ways to use this as a moment for reflection about our wants and our needs and our wishes. Ray, are there any opportunities that you see in this moment for those kinds of conversations?
Oh, to be sure. I think that the, when Tanya was initially talking about the difference between the language of a death-denying culture and a death-illiterate culture, there's something really important in that because, you know, all of us are going to die, and we know that we're going to die. But we simply don't see it. We don't see it up close. We may hear about it in a faraway land, but we don't see it up close. I think that the proximity of this crisis and the fact that people are dying quickly and in large numbers, and that the seriousness of this has shut down the economy and people are feeling the fallout of this threat in their pocketbooks and in their pantries that doesn't, you know, that are empty, in the interruption of their life. This is enough, I think, to shake us into wanting to become literate about what death means. And that doesn't only mean what death, you know, looks like the day that I die necessarily, but what death and its inevitability means for how I live today.
Yeah.
And that's the crucial thing.
Nina, what kind of death literacy would you love people to have and to be more prepared for before they come and end up seeing you at the very end?
Well, the beauty of this, too, has been I've had a lot of calls, really, about people who are thinking about it. Even if they're not sick, they are calling, they are making I think the best thing you can do is have a conversation with your family. I always tell people there's a difference between what you want and what may be good for your family at the time of your loss. So everybody wants to tell their family what they want them to do. But I said if you're really truly open to it, have the conversation about maybe what the family needs to help in their grief process. You may want to be cremated and just whatever with you, but maybe your family wants to may need a little bit more closure than that. You can say you're open to it and then let family members kind of decide. Also, if you don't have your insurance in place, this is the time to consider what your options are. Letting your family know where those things are, even if you have insurance, letting people know what you have done, if you've done anything, and if you haven't done anything, it's never too late until it's too late to have that conversation. So having it sooner than later is always best. So I hope people will consider the fact that it doesn't have to be a hard conversation.
So from the very...
Yeah,
just from the very practical to the spiritual, kind of so many layers in there. We're going to have to leave it there. But thank you so much to Nina Jones Mason, a funeral director with LSD Jones & Sons Funeral Service in Durham, and Dr. Raymond Barfield, a pediatric oncologist and palliative care physician with Duke Health. Thank you both so much.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
You can find out more about our show at our website, stateofthings.org. You can hear more about Nina in the feature Black Funerals, COVID-19, and the Importance of Saying Goodbye from WUNC's Leonita Inge. That's the State of Things for today. We would love to continue to hear from you about how the pandemic is affecting your life. Call us or shoot us a text at 919-980-5419. We'd especially love to know right now about how it is affecting your free time. The State of Things is brought to you from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Anita Rao.